right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks, what the fucksters? How's it going? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it if you haven't been here before. This is going to be an interesting episode, I think. I've been doing stuff. I've been out in the world. Many of you know that I'm touring, and I've been out on the road quite a bit. And on this little leg of the journey over the last weekend, I flew into D.C., and then I drove up to Jersey in Red Bank, the Count Basie Theater. As I'm recording this, I'll be doing Philadelphia tonight. But also, as many of you know, as I fly in and I drive around for hours and hours to these shows with no opener, just me in the car, thinking about things, thinking about my life, looking to the future, looking to the past, just trying to figure out how I'm situated in this world, in my body, in my mind, in my heart, asking the big questions of myself, and also thinking about the past and thinking about the nature of memory. And what do we really remember about ourselves? What does memory serve? Why do we even have it? It's malleable. I don't know if malleable is the right word, but over time it shifts, it changes. You may not remember things quite right. You may not have been at that place or been in that house or actually did the things you think you did. It's a strange thing, memory, as you get older. And certainly as I watch my father lose his, you realize that, you know, what are you really left with? And what do you really have when it comes to memory? So this is sort of about kind of reckoning with personal history a little bit. And it turns out like it's also reckoning with a collective history because I was in D.C. And what do you do in D.C.? What do I talk about? A lot these days is where we're heading as a country and what I feel is important or not important culturally and how culture has been hijacked, which is clearly true, by nefarious forces for the most part. Some just blatantly capitalistic forces, but certainly some nefarious forces when it comes to expression of history, of marginalized people's history. And I've just had an interesting experience lately that's sort of expanding my mind around this stuff. I just spent a week in Tulsa working on a television show created by, written by, produced by, acted by Native Americans, which is really a first in the history of this country. And it is a true form of American expression, of human expression that has been sort of denied us by the forces that have dictated what we take in culturally. I went to D.C. I didn't know what to do. You know, I've been going to a lot of museums of all different kinds. And I decided I would go to the National Museum of African American History and Culture, the Smithsonian. And I had a profound experience there, which one should have. But I also ended up, you know, touching base with my college roommate, Lance Mayon, who I lived with on and off. Yeah, I lived with him for 4 years, two in student housing and two after the student housing. And then there was never any sort of problem or rift between us, but I missed almost all of his life. And I would touch base with him occasionally, maybe three or four times in the last 35 years. But it's interesting what I have found in touching base with people from my past, certain people, is that there isn't that much distance between us as human beings or our experience of each other, that there's some parts of us that remain the same, it seems. And there are some things that aren't quite, that I don't remember about myself and that he may not remember. So I ended up talking to him and putting some pieces together and having that experience of wondering, you know, who we were and how we got to where we are and just reconnecting like that. So there was sort of a personal history. And I also in New Jersey ended up spending time with the other two guys that Lance and I lived with for 2 years, Anthony Calabrese and Brad Stoneberg. It was kind of a profound and fun experience to reconnect with these guys because they're all very familiar to me, even though it's been, 35 to 40 years since I've seen these guys. It was just very interesting to me. But moving back, the museum, I don't know if you've been there, all right, but the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture is relatively new. It's new to me. It's right on the National Mall. It's right down the street from the Holocaust Museum. I mean, I would imagine that doubleheader would be profoundly overwhelming and heartbreaking and horrific. But one thing I started to realize, sadly, you know, these are two museums that are monuments, memorials, and also archival collections, and to some degree, both are a reckoning. These should act as sort of a sobering warning, but also these should be both the things that those two museums represent, the worst type of murderous, genocidal anti-Semitism, and then the worst type of human bondage, slavery, and then the ongoing systemic racism that has been a problem in this country and continues to be one. Both of these should have been in the past. We should have evolved as a culture, as a civilization, as a country beyond what these two museums represent. But sadly, it seems that new exhibits will be added in the years to come. And hopefully the point of view remains appropriate of both these museums. But we don't know ultimately how this country is going to go. But the fact is, this is an ongoing concern. The design of the museum itself is this sort of triptych. It's like got three levels, and it's based on a Nigerian piece of headgear from several sculptures. And I love architecture that sort of infuses all of the things that it represents. The sort of steel work on the outside, I guess it's steel lattice work, is sort of based on some of the work of the blacksmiths that were trained and were artisans in New Orleans post-slavery, who had learned these crafts while they were slaves or working, you know, as indentured servants. And so just the aesthetic of the place, and there was a thoughtful kind of, there's a reflecting pool, but there's also something that represents a porch in the architecture as a communal meeting place and place where stories are told. So it's a fascinating sort of design just on an architectural level. And as I talked to Dr. Dwandalyn Reese, who is the curator of music and performing arts at the museum, and she's been there, you know, since 2009. That was before the physical museum wasn't even opened, which opened in 2016. But what is amazing about the reality of not only the subject matter of the museum, but that there was an effort to get this museum open for the past 100 years, a museum to represent the African-American contribution to this country, 100 years. And now it sits in proximity to the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, and the White House. And the way she kind of talked about it, and the way it sort of made sense to me, that it is in a silent conversation with all of these symbolic spaces. Like, I felt something about that. You know, like I've been to D.C. with different states of mind. When I was younger, when you get there and you see it for the first time, the monuments are overwhelming and you realize this is supposed to be overwhelming. It's supposed to represent the sort of glory and the stature and the mythic importance of the U.S. democracy and what this country represents. But at different times, you know, I've been there during protests where you realize, like, you're just being dwarfed by the mythological importance of what this country is supposed to represent, and you're actively trying to push back against it or work within it to make change. And then, you know, I went there during the Trump years where it represented something gray and dark, and you realize that it could be gutted and emptied and used for completely nefarious and corrupt purposes, which it has been since the beginning of U.S. government. And then when you go into this museum and experience the history of slavery in a way that you will never experience it, you realize that it was, you know, completely supported at different points in time by this government. And then a blind eye was turned, or legislation wasn't created to make things correct, to make things right. It was a slow process that is backtracking. It's falling back. And the way it's designed is, you go, there are several floors downstairs, which sort of represent the history of African-American people in the 1600s, where the entire sort of global history of slavery, you know, heading into the Americas, you know, before it was even the United States of America. But it was so specific and so in depth, and I couldn't take it all in. How do you really get it? It's very hard to be truly empathetic. It's hard to put yourself in someone else's shoes without knowing where they walked in from to truly understand the depth of it. And when you go to this museum, you understand the depth of it. Even if you see the shackles, you see the boats, you hear testimonies and read testimonies, you see the founding fathers and the history of early slavery in this country and the bloody, horrendous, inhumane treatment of human beings by other human beings, which really stood out to me as something it's very hard for me to understand, but it's as consistent with world history as is civilization, is this horrific, violent, completely demeaning treatment, murderous treatment of human on human interaction, enslaving. What I found going through it is that I had a visceral and human experience, and that my empathy expanded into something human and not just an idea or just a knowledge of. It expanded because of the museum and the process, because you go through those bottom floors and you see the struggle, you know, moving from like the 1600s all the way up through now, through the civil rights movement, through the Voting Rights Act, through everything. And even without being able to put the amount of time necessary to take it all in, my entire brain was sort of reconfigured in terms of the depth of empathy possible and an understanding and respect for that struggle. And the way I noticed it, oddly, because when you go upstairs, the upstairs is really about the African-American contributions in music, fashion, literature, dance, theater, commerce, design, all of it. And it's beautiful. And you kind of really move through it. But if you spend the correct amount of time in the darkness, in the basement, and you come up into the world of accomplishment, you are deeply informed and empathetic to where it all comes from in terms of African-American expression. Like, I went to have an amazing visual art exhibit at one of the galleries called Reckoning, I believe it's called, and it's painting and sculpture. And the aesthetic that, like, just even looking at modern art or paintings that represent African-American themes or by African-American artists, because I was downstairs and because something happened in my brain and in my heart, the depth of my empathy and my understanding of the aesthetic that informs all of the artwork, like it just expanded and gave me a sort of type of respect and type of empathy that I did not quite have before. I had a sort of like, yeah, it's terrible. You know, I feel bad. It was a terrible thing. But now it was living and active. And now, like, you know, my perception of the experience of Black Americans is totally different. You know, this is a national museum and this functions as a museum. It is not ideological. It is a museum of history of the United States of America. And the fact that, you know, in almost half of the states that have Republican state legislatures, that you're not going to be taught this history, it's fundamentally anti-American, but is something worse than that. It is a whitewashing. It is a step backwards. So I recommend going to the museum, but I was happy to talk to Dr. Reese. She goes by Dwan. We talked a bit about, the museum. And it was profound to me. What are you finding in terms of the visitors' experience? What's been the experience watching people come in here for the past few years?
It is, you know, when we started, we ended up with the longest dwell time ever. People were staying here 5-6 hours, whole days. The typical average is maybe an hour and a half in a museum. So people are touched by the content. Really, and I'll walk in the galleries from time to time. I'm really heartened by the intergenerational dialogues that go on from the younger people, from kids to young adults who didn't know a lot of this stuff and are visibly moved, to people who actually lived it, to people who never got the grasp and how they feel about this history and being witness to it in this way. It's a very powerful experience for people.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone walks out of there untouched in some way or another.
Right.
And that's heartening.
Yeah.
Because it's giving people a chance to deal with difficult history and difficult stories, but also to affirm that what happened to real people. That the transatlantic slave trade, we were dealing with people as commodities. That it's hard to not point out how horrific that system was. And then what you happen when you see in the other exhibits is the legacy of it that we're still grappling with today.
Yeah, that was what I realized that was sort of horrifying when I was coming over here, is that, you know, between this and some of the other monuments and even the Holocaust Museum, is that there's still an evolving history of this type of hatred and violence.
Yes.
That it's not finished yet. Like, this isn't behind us. This isn't a memorial
No, it's very much, we'd like to say, or our new director, living history.
Yeah.
We're living it at the moment. And I bet there's any moment that we're dealing with right now that you could find someplace in the museum where you feel like it's history repeating itself.
And also some of the stuff that I found to be, like, I don't think I ever had a full picture of, not just necessarily what slavery built or what it did to this country, but, you know, how much of skill sets and everything that they didn't, you know, that weren't here until these people were kidnapped and brought here. I didn't know so much of that stuff. And I don't know that I know it now, but I do know that I have a much broader understanding of what happened historically.
Sure. I think even in school, you're not taught that.
I don't remember hardly anything.
There's kind of
school.
A basic, but there's a basic, even, you know, I was in high school in the 80s.
Yeah.
It's kind of a basic narrative. All these intricate stories, whether you're dealing with African Americans, Native Americans, and the different point of view.
Yeah. Nothing.
That's never elevated to the point where you have a complicated but nuanced understanding.
Right.
Of how our history played out.
Right. Well, I think that's why they have, I guess, entire majors in college that are based on that. I mean, it's hard to bring all that together, but I think they did it here to some degree, you know? I mean, it's all down there, but it's like you can only, I mean, I had no idea about the expansiveness of the global slave trade.
Yes. Yes. We've got a Center for the Study of Global Slavery. We're working with other collaborating partners. We'll be doing an exhibit about that in about 2 to 3 years, because it's a global concern. It's an ongoing, still contemporary concern.
Isn't that crazy?
And we're not particularly attuned to that. We weren't taught that way.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the concept when I was growing up, just American slavery, I never thought about the global nature. And even I love the prehistory that we get before we get to the transatlantic slave trade.
Yeah.
About just globalism and building societies and capitalism. It just all plays out.
That's the thing that really comes through in the lower galleries, is that by all the sort of accounts of the experience of slavery or people writing about it who were there, all the way through now even, but I mean the lynchings and the assassinations and stuff, is that when I'm down there, I can't understand how another human being can do that to somebody else. And the fact that it exists makes me very frightened for the future, in a sense, that people are capable of the worst possible things you can imagine. And I think it's hard to wrap your brain about that. You know it if you read it in history books, but to go down there and see it like you guys have laid it out here, you feel it. And I don't know that that's always possible.
So let me ask you this question.
Yeah.
The seeing versus the knowing. What was the difference for you in that gallery? Was it the knowledge, the exhibition, the objects? What made it real for you?
I don't think it was. I think it was the way it was laid out and the thoroughness of the history. And in terms of, like, when you really think about, I think some of the nuances around the idea of people being, you know, literally taken from their homes, from their communities, from their family, and then on through families being separated in, you know, in slave auctions and whatnot. And I knew it, but seeing it written and then seeing some of the artifacts, like, yeah, certainly the shackles and the, you know, I'd seen the pictures of the ships before, but there was something about the narratives and the immersive experience of being in there, the voices even, that all contributed to me having a more human sense of it.
Yeah.
Human interaction with it.
Yeah, and I think that's why it works.
Yeah.
Abstract to human beings. And then you, in certain ways, when you start to hear these stories, you try to imagine, what would it be, you know, if I were separated from my parents as a child, forcibly? I mean, you can't imagine
it. You can't imagine it.
And the pain and the...
Right. It's very hard to get in touch with the correct amount of empathy, because it's almost devastating.
Yeah.
You know? There was something about not only the inhumanity of how people were treated, but the fact that they couldn't get this place built as a monument to African Americans' contribution to American life and culture up until a few years ago. I mean, it's still not right. I mean, you know, here you've got this entire rice business built in the Carolinas by African farmers who knew how to do it, and they got nothing for it but misery and enslavement. And that concept, that idea of not giving credit where credit's due and not, you know, having a just society exists. That, why would this be a question to put this place up 10 years ago, 20 years ago even? I mean, it's crazy.
You know, things move slowly. You know, there are things that are happening today, and it's like, this should have not been an issue at this point.
I know. And it's like, I come out of there thinking, like, there is some serious part of the Civil War that has not been resolved.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just as we have not reckoned with some of the negative aspects of the country. I mean, the discussion over race, the Civil War. I mean, these images. And if you can't acknowledge something, it's really difficult to heal.
Yeah. And I mean, I went to that museum in Alabama.
I haven't been to that.
To the lynching museum with the hanging monoliths. Oh my God, that was like, that leveled me. Like in the same way that, like, for some reason the art really connects with me. Even those bricks behind Jefferson downstairs. I mean, it's a similar kind of thing, where you have this representation, these symbolic representations that put the numbers in perspective. You know, how does this, in terms of when you have conversations about how the museum evolves, what are those conversations? Like, are you going to be constantly curating new exhibits? Like the painting exhibit and the art exhibit upstairs, The Reckoning, is that something that gallery, you know, is going to change quarterly or half every year?
It won't quarterly. That was a big redo when we opened that last year. So it was a revisioning of that gallery.
Yeah.
It was a permanent gallery. I envision more incarnations of showing the artwork and engaging it with the rest of the subject matter of the museum. We generally rotate objects on a yearly basis. Of course, COVID put that on hold. We have temporary exhibition gallery. You know, at some point, we may think about redoing the permanent exhibits, but that's still a ways off. But we're also investigating new places to have more space to do more content. A lot of that's going to take place digitally, because the possibilities, not only getting the content out of people, but what we can do with it. You know, even with an exhibition, you can only do so much. So we have something now that we just launched this fall, the Searchable Museum, which takes that Slavery and Freedom Gallery, but makes it a digital online component and helps establish some of the relationships and stories that you really couldn't do spaciously on exhibit floor. So you may want to check that out.
So you can just sort of like do little bits and pieces of shifting up the exhibits a little bit. I noticed some pieces were missing, but obviously, you know, some of the larger things are going to stay there because they're permanent, but there's artifacts that you can just move in and out.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and that's our key purpose, is to make the collection accessible to the public. And so the exhibits are just one way. A lot of the research that goes on, publications.
Yeah.
We have a partnership with Smithsonian Folkways. We do recordings.
Oh, the recordings. Yeah,
we just did the hip-hop anthology last year.
With them?
Yes, that was a partnership.
Yet?
Oh, yeah, it came out in August.
On vinyl?
I wonder. Couldn't afford to do it on vinyl.
I was not, sorry.
It was... You know, ask
that. It was a whole thing. How many?
We had 129 tracks.
Oh, wow.
9 CDs. And I know the CDs are obsolete, but it's a 300-page illustrated book with photographs, objects, and essays, but really putting a history around hip-hop.
Yeah.
And we did that kind of, it was kind of a ground-up project where we really brought in, you know, the hip hop community to select the tracks and everything
I gotta look for that. It's so weird that's the Jefferson Monument right there, right?
Yes.
You can just see it.
Uh-huh.
And it's hard not to you know, that kind of...
Yeah, if you sit here, yeah, you think about that. And you saw that Jefferson statue, there it is right here.
There's the monument.
And these conversations, these spaces, you know, just... They're instantly in dialogue with one another.
So now, how do you feel about, in terms of the museum, like you're talking about this online presence, but we're now, you know, at this, you know, this place in history where they might not allow that in half the schools in this country.
We're a resource.
Yeah.
We're a resource for the public.
Yeah.
And we will keep providing this kind of content, engaging in a variety of issues, and that is part of our mission.
Right.
You know, we're the public's institution, and this is the work we do. So we will always be doing that.
Right. And what separates it from a philosophical thing is that it's an archive. It's a historical museum.
Yes.
It's not, you know, it doesn't have an agenda other than to educate and to represent the history of the country.
Educate, represent the history of the country from an African-American diasporic point of view.
Thank you for talking to me.
Sure. Thanks for visiting.
Yeah,
and you have to come back.
Well, I'm going to have to come back to finish. So I don't know really what to say about this other than I've been going to a lot of museums and I've been reflecting on a lot of things. And just because of, I don't know, wherever my heart is or my mind is or whatever my age is, you know, I'm more available to be a little more, you know, empathetic, open-hearted. And it's very heartbreaking and satisfying to engage on this level. And I think it's important that we all engage with our shared history and not just, you know, rely on past memories or just, you know, chunks of information that informs our emotions that, you know, we can have control over. Because if you go to this museum, it's profoundly human and profoundly horrific and dug in deep into our collective experience. And moving on from that, you know, it just so happened that I'm in DC and I'm kind of trying to put things together in terms of my sense of self and who I am and what did I come from. And it just seems to be going, it's an ongoing thing. And I'm pretty clear on who I am, but I'm kind of like, I don't know who I am from other people's point of view. And, you know, it was just interesting because I figured like, well, fuck it. Let's just talk to Lance. I mean, obviously there's a lot of people throughout my life I could talk to, even people in my current life, but I hadn't talked to Lance for a while and we were very close. But we lived together for 4 years and we worked together in places and we caught up and I recorded it. This is me talking to my old roommate, Lance Mayen.
Hey, buddy.
How are you, man?
How are you?
Good to see you.
I'm all right.
What's the matter with your life?
Retirement can kill you.
Is it? Yeah?
Yeah.
How long have you been retired?
Barely a month. I'm already half in the grave. Well, you start doing stupid things. So, like, you know, I'm retired from being a chef because I don't want to run kitchens anymore. But
right.
I still want to work. And a buddy of mine is a landscaper, and it's pretty physical work. And, you know, I'm 59 going to 25, but feeling like I'm 59.
Yeah.
And climbing in and out of a truck, and I fell into the bed of his truck, and then some fucking woman at the end is going, "Are you okay?" And I wasn't, and so I've been in pain for like 4 days.
Because so this is your retirement.
Yeah, this is
great.
How I enjoy myself.
You did it. You did.
I did. I'm finally there.
But wait, you're at my age, right?
A little older. I'll be 60 this year.
Okay, so I'm going to be 59 this year.
Yeah, so a year.
And. Because like I think about retiring, and I think because in my brain, even though I don't live a life that's like that, it feels like something that we're supposed to be working towards, like to stop.
Wasn't that why you worked in the first place?
An old idea.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if that's really the idea still, but it's what we were kind of brought up
with. I'm good with it. Trust me. Yeah, I've been working for over 40 years, and man, it does, you know, and I've always been like, you know, the workaholic, you know, drive that shit into my kids. And,
yeah.
And now they're going, but you don't want to work anymore. I'm like, I'm done.
And but are you
about face?
Then why are you fucking in a truck?
Well, you know, you're outside.
Yeah, but
it's nice. And oh wait, I didn't tell you this. So the first week, I punctured my arm. You can see what's left of it. I punctured my arm with this cotter pin on the bottom of a wheelbarrow.
Yeah.
Loaded into the same freaking truck I fell in.
Yeah.
And I had to get a tetanus shot. So that was my first week. And then this week, I fell trying to swing my leg over the top of his bed, and I fell right into it at a nursery, and, you know, I look like an ass.
So this is, I mean, do you feel like you deserve this?
What, the pain?
Yeah, the punishment. Well, what are you, I don't just know. Making a fool?
Somebody's getting the revenge on me. That's for sure.
But like, here's the thing: I don't understand, because I really feel like I could just do nothing, because I feel like I do that most of the time only because I'm self-employed. So it never, it's not like I'm going to work,
right?
Right. So it's never felt like that for me. But I work my ass off. But I really feel like I could do nothing. But now, talking to you, I don't know.
Don't do landscaping.
Well, no, but
I'll tell you that right now.
That's the kind of fucking thing I would think I could do. My father, you know, he retired for a while, and tried to be a mailman.
Oh, that's not easy.
No, I know.
It's actually hard. There's dogs. There's the bag is heavy.
Right, but what are you doing?
I don't know. I'm thinking I'm young. You know, I go to the gym.
Yeah.
It's not the same.
No. So I was trying to think, like, because when was the last time I saw you before?
Had to be before COVID, right?
The last time I did this place?
Kennedy Center. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, and we went out to dinner and we caught up. It's so weird,
yeah,
man.
At the Ritz.
Because when I hang out with you, I don't, even though we never see each other, I did it with Jimmy, too. Jim Loftus, I saw.
Yeah, I remember Jim. Yep.
And Cliff, you didn't know, from my freshman year of college. There's just that period in our life where, you know, I see you and it doesn't feel different.
No.
You don't feel that different to me.
No.
I mean, I know we've had entire lifetimes, but this frequency is the same. Am I the same?
Yeah, I think so. I'm thinking like, I was thinking about today and right over here. It's like, how long have we known each other? I mean, sophomore year had to be 1983?
83, right? Yeah.
So it's like 36
years? I transferred. Yeah, it's like 36 years.
Yeah, it's a long
it's
freaking time.
It's fucking nuts.
Yeah.
And, but there's this whole chunk of it that, you know, I don't know, you know, I don't know where you, I remember, I was thinking there's these bits and pieces after college. I didn't see you that much, but we lived together for sophomore.
Junior, senior, the senior year we had the apartment together.
Junior and senior. There's a videotape of us playing air guitar and air drums to an entire side of Pink Floyd's Animals somewhere.
I'm sure we are, you know, there's some influence there.
But do you remember, like, I don't remember how. Well, I remember what happened at that apartment is, like, you started seeing Kathy and she moved in, and I just came home once and you had sectioned off half of the living room with like a sheet.
Well, my bedroom was the size of the bed.
I know that, but
it was really small.
I just walk in, there's just a curtain cutting the living room in half.
Yeah, well, I'm not an architect.
But there was no discussion. It was just sort of like, all right. That was funny.
It didn't last.
Because your bedroom, like, is a patio.
It was. Yeah, it was. It was tiny. It was a porch. Patio.
Yeah, a porch.
Yeah.
Do you remember us meeting? Like, do you remember how we got?
No, I do. I remember with the Park Drive. Is that the street?
Yeah, that was on Park Drive. Oh, yeah.
I had already gotten there. My folks. Yeah, we got there.
Vic and then Patty, right?
And
what's your mom's name?
Patricia.
Yeah.
Yep. And then you showed up.
Yeah.
You were the first guy I met.
Right. Right. There's that weird awkwardness. Yeah. Like, oh, what kind of guy are you? What are we doing here?
No, we hit it off, though.
Yeah,
I think. And I do remember this. I remember
records. It was about records.
Yep. Music.
Yeah.
And
what do you remember?
Do you remember going to remember they had an RA, right? We had an RA for the building.
Right. It was a girl, a woman.
Yeah. I don't remember her name. So she had and I remember this is Kathy, you know, now my wife, but her first impression of us was we showed up at the RA meeting with everybody else from the apartment.
Yeah.
And you and I had bathrobes on and cowboy boots. She just thought it wasn't a good look. You know? She wasn't impressed.
What were we doing?
I don't know. Just being ourselves. You know,
No one else was there.
We certainly didn't care what people thought. You know, remember we used to go down to the duck pond and, you know, take shrooms and sit in the trees.
So we can talk freely now. You're not worried about your kids here?
They've already heard other shit.
you had to come clean?
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, due to your show.
I know. I remember. What's the story of that? How'd that happen?
A buddy of mine who listens to you regularly. I guess you mentioned it was when you had, what the hell's his name?
I'm sorry if it gets hot. I just didn't want
to sound Pauly Shore.
Oh, Pauly Shore.
You were interviewing him, and then you came up with some story. Well, it wasn't made up, but it actually happened.
Oh, yeah.
Where the two of us were, I think we dropped acid on Halloween, and we dressed like, well, not intentionally, but gay rockabilly. We didn't know what to dress as.
We were pressured for a costume.
Yeah.
We wanted to go to parties, and we ended up just greasing our hair up.
And wearing like leather.
Yeah. And then we ended up in the basement of that apartment.
Well, we went to the apartment, and somebody must have pulled the fire alarm like as soon as we got there.
Oh, yeah.
So everybody bailed, and then you and I were like, well, we're still in the fucking apartment. We went down to the basement and started running around with heating ducts on our heads,
like laughing our asses off.
And then the fire department walked in with axes and shit. Yeah. Looking out and literally said, take me to your leader. And we ran out laughing like idiots.
But why wouldn't we?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, there's that story. But then what happened was, getting back to my kids,
finding out,
a buddy of mine listened to that episode and then realized you were talking about me because you mentioned my name.
Yeah.
And he goes, hey, you know Mark Maron? I go, yeah, Mark and I, you know, I've known him for years. We went to school together. Yeah. And so he made a copy of the CD. He made a copy, right? And gave me a copy so I could hear it.
Back before you knew how to
use an
iPod or anything.
And then, of course, it got to some other friends of ours, which he gave a copy of it to. And my wife is going, you know, the kids are going to find out. I said, Nick, you know, they were younger, right? My son was 17 at the time. Right. They don't know who Mark is. They're not going to listen. They have no idea.
Yeah.
Well, I was at our pool, and one of Nick's friends came up to me and said, Mr. Maron, my wife came up to me. She goes, you're busted. I go, what? She goes, Mark Maron. I go, why? She goes, you know, Kevin's friend of my son's came up to me and said, Mrs. Maron, was Mr. Maron Mark Maron's roommate in college? And she knew right away.
Yeah, trouble.
She knew that he must have heard that episode where you and I dressed as gay rockabillys on acid.
Yeah.
So after that, I couldn't say shit to my kids about anything. I was like, that was it.
I blew it.
Yeah, it's over.
Yeah, no.
Do what you want.
But I wonder how, I don't know, I don't have kids, but I guess that you really have to hide that shit in order to be disciplinary.
Well, yeah.
Can't you still warn them and say, like, it wasn't good?
But no, right. So fun. Yeah. I know it sounded like fun the way Mark described it, but it was terrible. It was an awful experience, and I only did it 10 more times.
Yeah. We did do it another time. It's so weird because I knew... We spend so much fucking time together, so you really do know people. I was sort of trying to figure that out, why, because the guy, Cliff, who I was in freshman year with, I saw him a couple weeks ago. And like, I knew that guy for a year, but it's because it was that time in our lives where it's just like, it makes an imprint.
Yeah.
And then those people get frozen like that, and then you see him later and you're like, is that the same guy? How is it not going to be the same guy unless you have a brain injury or something? But you're pretty much the same.
I am.
I think I remember, dude, I think I got you into the food business.
You did. It was at Edibles?
Was it Edibles? But then I started thinking, didn't we both work at the veggie cafeteria?
We worked at ARA? Was that what it was?
Was the food company, but we were in the veggie one.
I remember working for the cafeteria.
Yeah, yeah. And serving, that was what but you weren't cooking back then. We were just serving, right?
I don't remember anything.
I remember there was this...
I don't think I was cooking. I don't ever remember handling a spatula.
I remember the black dude that was the head cook there. And I remember I was in the veggie cafeteria because I used to name... We were just fucking joking around. And the veggie cafeteria, we weren't veggies, but it was better food. And I remember naming some of the items and I put it up on the board.
You got to name the items?
Well, like they would have like, you know, mozzarella casserole or something. I put something on there like the pride of kings.
And that explains it.
Yeah, and then people would come up and go, I'll take the pride of kings. And I just laughed and laughed to myself.
It contains mozzarella.
Yeah. Do you remember you were in a musical?
Yeah.
And you had like one, I remember you had one scene where you did a noose thing. You're like, yep, like this.
Yeah, I cast some parts. Steve Brill got me into that.
He did?
He told me to go try out for it.
For the musical.
The Chicago.
Because he thought you, because you always were singing and I'm a goof.
So I did it.
Yeah, and you did Chicago. Because I remember like there was one night where, where the fuck were we? We were in Boston and we were getting fucked up somewhere. And I had that old, my brother's shitty Camaro. And we were like, let's go to New York.
Yeah. And we had no money.
We had no money and no place to go. And it was like 1 a.m. and we committed. And it was so dumb.
It was me, you, Brill, and I think Gaffney.
I don't know if Gaffney was there, but I remember we just go to my aunt's house in New Jersey.
You remember getting pulled over by the cop?
Kinda.
And it was, I thought it was like McLeod. He came up and goes, how long are you planning on staying in town? Like, who the fuck are you? I mean, who asked that question?
This isn't a
Hollywood movie.
When we got into Jersey?
Yeah, well, we're just here to see his grandmother.
Yeah.
So I don't know, in a couple hours, sir? Is that enough?
And then we crashed.
Yeah.
In her basement on the floor in that rug basement. And then we're like, well, I guess we got to go to the city.
Yeah, we went to Soho.
Yeah, and then we did nothing. We ate lunch and left.
I think Brill paid for it. I think he was the only one with a credit card.
Oh, really?
I think so. I think he bought us lunch.
And then you were like, I got to get to rehearsal.
That's what the start is, full circle.
Yeah, we had to go to work or something and drive back. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I remember not having any sleep. And, you know, we ran every toll.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. That was crazy.
We couldn't pay for a toll.
I know. It was just so dumb. It was so dumb.
Yeah, because it was like 1 o'clock in the morning. We didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
It's like, well, let's go to New York. It's not that far.
Do you remember when I wanted to do comedy?
Yeah, and you were doing open mic nights. So you and I'd go up to, like, I don't know if it was Played Against Sam's, but there's another one that was up there in Alston area.
Yeah, there was Played Against Sam's was definitely up there. Really? So that was during college?
Yes.
When I first tried it?
Yep. And it may have been senior year, but I do remember it.
A couple of times.
Yeah.
And it was brutal, right?
Well, you're better now. You gotta cut your teeth at some point, right?
No, I know, but I just I kind of remember like trying to do jokes in, like, I was interested in doing it because I know that me and Brill did the team thing, but you saw me by myself because that was after he graduated, so it must have been that summer. But there was a night where I tried to do it for some college thing, and I just remember, and I'll cop to it, I had one of my own jokes, and then I did one Woody Allen joke, and then I did like anything to get through it. And then, but I kind of remember always being interested in it and doing that other shit. It's wild.
Well, I do remember going to a couple places with you in actual comedy clubs.
Waiting around?
And, well, having you, and there was an open mic night.
Yeah.
You just go up and you were able to do it. You did a couple of minutes and, it was rough, but I mean, you got better, so.
Was I fucking out of my mind? Was I, like, panicked?
It takes balls.
And was that crazy and panicked? I remember being panicked.
I remember you, like, rehearsing to yourself prior to getting up there. You know, a lot of practice. You know, a lot of.
I don't remember that part of myself. I don't remember the rehearsing part.
Yeah.
But I must have done it.
Telling your jokes over and over in your head.
When did we...
You did one where you kind of stacked up the chairs.
I went to the Museum of Modern Art.
Was that what it was? Yeah.
I put the mic stand on the top of the stool.
Yes.
And I think I hang something from the top. And I'm like, just at the Museum of Modern Art. And I just wanted to sit there to get the first laugh. And it kind of worked. I remember it
worked.
So
remember that joke?
I do remember that joke.
So did I.
That's pretty good. That's six.
See?
I remember a couple of jokes from that set. I just remember being out back smoking. We were both smoking.
You don't still smoke, right?
No.
Yeah, I quit a long time ago.
I mean, I haven't, like, I was on nicotine lozenges forever.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I couldn't get off them, but I've been off everything now for a few years.
I don't even like the smell.
Yeah, I don't.
It's like.
Yeah, I notice it. I don't know if I don't like it, but I don't know. How long has it been since you smoked?
Oh, New Year's Eve. 1999.
Have you had any major health things?
Like what?
Heart attack?
No, nothing like that. I've injured myself several times. I do a lot of that.
Dude, like,
I play softball, and you think it's like there's this kind of a benign sport. You know, it's a nice bunch of older guys getting together playing softball. Yeah. I've had surgery because of it.
Yeah.
I mean, fractured my finger last year.
But everything else is all right.
Yeah, health-wise, other than
and your mom's still around.
Yeah, she's still doing really well.
That's
She'll be
great.
88 in July.
88.
Yep. Yeah, she loves you.
Oh, yeah.
She saw you in Respect.
Oh, yeah.
Right, like, so she goes, oh, Michael, I didn't realize you had such a big role.
Yeah, I remember them well. Yeah. I remember Vic, Hyper Vic.
Oh, yes.
How'd he pass away?
ALS.
Oh, really?
Lou Gehrig's, yeah.
Oh, they take
Yeah, that was brutal. A tough person to get that because, you know, he was so opposite.
Wired.
You know, I mean, yeah, he was nuts.
And your brother Pat and then the other one, Farron.
Farron, yep.
Farron, the giant.
Well, Pat was bigger, but Farron was the ex-Marine.
I just very remember intense. That time, man. You remember that time where I don't know why he stopped by the place when we lived on the second floor and he had his guns with him.
Because he goes everywhere with his guns. Gotta have your gun.
Do you remember, like, you know, I hadn't met him before and he stopped by and you and I were in the kitchen and he was in your room, which had that amazing bay window. You had that corner room.
Yeah,
and we walk in and he's just sighting people.
Oh, he wasn't really going to shoot anybody.
No, I know that, but it was just that moment where we looked at each other.
He did shoot a pan once.
A pan?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
It's an odd story. He's probably the only person alive who's ever done it.
Is he around still?
Oh, yeah. But he called me. This is as I was, you know, I'm a chef at this point.
Yeah.
And he called me up one day. And he goes, hey, Lance, I bought a cast iron skillet. He goes, and I'm trying to season it so it becomes, you know, stick, you know.
Sure.
So, like.
It's
so
a chef's question.
Yeah, so he wanted to be like non-stick, right?
Yeah.
So he goes, how do you season? He goes, you got directions. You can put oil in it, bake it. You can turn it on, let the oil get hot, do that sort of thing. And there's a few ways you could do it.
Yeah.
And he goes, all right. So he does it. He calls me up a couple of days later. He goes, God damn it. He goes, I seasoned this pan. I've done it like three different freaking ways. He goes, the shit still sticks to it because I'm really getting pissed. I'm going, okay, try this. And then I don't hear from him for a while. And I don't know, maybe a month or two goes by and he called me. We're just talking. I go, hey, by the way, how's that, you know, your nonstick pan coming along? He goes, I shot it. Yeah. I go, what? He goes, yeah, the fucking thing. I got so mad one day. I was cooking fish in it, and I did all the things right, and it keeps sticking. So I got pissed off. I took it out in the back, put it against a tree, and shot it with my 44.
Oh, my God.
I go, wow. Okay, you got neighbors.
Off of that thing?
No, it's brittle, so it went right through it. Oh, yeah. So I said, well, how are you cooking your fish? He goes, put the fish in the oil in the pan, turn the heat on. I'm like, wait a minute, what'd you do? Yeah. He goes, I put the fish in the oil in the pan, and I turn the heat on. I go, so you put it in a cold pan?
Yeah.
He goes, well, it was going to get hot. I go, you can't cook shit in a cold pan. It's going to stick every fucking time.
Yeah.
I go, you shot up an innocent pan because you're an idiot. I mean, you know, but by the way, it doesn't make a Teflon.
Yeah.
It
no, just, no, I know. You know, I do the cast iron thing. Yeah. I mean, you can't expect it to be like a nonstick pan.
And he truly bought it and believed and really that that's what it was going to become. It was going to be just like
a like Teflon pan.
And so that pan got
what that guy
coming.
End up doing with his wife, Farron?
He went to work with my father and brother. Okay. They took over the company.
Do they still got it?
They sold it 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah? So yep. They're both retired?
Yep, 2 or 3 years ago. Yep. No yeah, they're kidding. Older than me.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And everyone's got kids?
Yep, two, and two.
Wow.
Yep.
So let's catch up with that. So after college, like I went directly home, and then you went, but you didn't go immediately to culinary school. I remember it was
no,
took a while.
10 years.
10 years before you did?
I was 31.
Where were you working?
I was a photographer for a minute in Boston.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. What were you taking pictures of?
Grip and grin stuff. It was, I remember we had to do the Boston Marathon.
Oh, so
and the owner of this guy, he was a dick.
You're like a stringer?
I guess.
Is that what you call it?
So, I mean, we had different assignments. But we had our jackets, you know, for the marathon and shit like that. It was cool collateral. And I remember that year. So this guy, Mark, who was the owner, we weren't in the places he wanted us to be yet. And then he literally told like the marshal or whoever of the marathon, he goes, you gotta hold the marathon from starting. And the guy's like, who the fuck are you? Yeah. We're going to stop the Boston Marathon so you can get your photographers in place. He goes, no, you get you guys in place. We're going to go without you. Not, or, you know,
yeah.
So this guy had balls. I mean, he just like, he thought he could actually dictate how the Boston Marathon was to be
stop
run.
The marathon.
And, they didn't listen to him, of course. So
you're a photographer and that craps out.
Well, I ended up, sort of. So I was doing stock photography, but it takes too much work.
Yeah.
So I sold some stuff. I got, you know, I was in some magazines. Mm. And I ended up going part-time at a camera store.
Yeah.
And then they're like, well, after like
in
a few
Boston?
Months. Yeah. Underground cameras in Cambridge Square.
Yeah.
And after a few months, they said, do you want to just go full-time? I'm like, yeah, all right. I'm not doing anything else. So I did. And then they asked me if I wanted to be a manager, and then I was doing that for like 8 years. And
that's you managed a camera store?
Yeah, for a while.
I have no fucking idea.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what the fuck, well, where was I? See, it's so weird that we have these like very specific college memories, but then like there's all this huge swath of time where we didn't talk to each other at all. I had no idea you're managing a fucking camera store.
Yeah, then it was Ritz Camera bought them out, and then I worked for Ritz, and then now they're out. They're defunct. They went out of business.
Yeah, because I remember staying at that apartment in the North End, and you were trying to make Aspic. Like, you were in cooking school, and you were sitting there trying.
No, I couldn't have been at the North End.
You sure?
I wasn't in culinary school until I was here.
Really?
Yeah.
Were you trying to be a cook then? Because I
always did stuff. I mean, was I trying to make an aspic, really?
Yeah, I just, that's sort of what I remember.
I had gelatin and
stock. Yeah, yeah. I remember like you were working on it.
I must have gotten that. I was probably doing some recipe. I was going to make some shit.
Yeah.
I don't know. I remember making a really bad, some kind of pie with dried thyme, and it was supposed to be fresh thyme.
Yeah.
So it just,
didn't work out.
It was fucking horrible. My parents are coming over. I made this thing. I was like, you guys can't eat this.
Oh, my God.
So luckily we lived in the North End. There are a lot of restaurants.
There were good restaurants.
Yeah.
But when did you move here and why? To D.C.?
I moved down here. We moved down here because I got transferred.
For the camera store?
Yeah, to take on one of the bigger stores down here.
Really?
Yeah. So and that was in, I don't know, 90 something.
And then what makes you decide you're going to be a chef?
Well, I've been doing the camera thing for like 8 years, and you know, I was going, yeah, retail sucks.
Yeah.
You know, after a while, I was like, I don't want to fucking do this anymore. So Kathy, who, of course, you tell her something, and she, next thing you know, you have a book.
Yeah.
She's great that way. But so I just happened to message, because I always liked to cook. You remember you and I cooked, and
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I just liked it.
Cook,
yeah, man.
And, I still cook all the fucking time.
I just said, I said to her, you know what? I don't know. I think I might want to go back to culinary school. Oh, I know what it was. We went on vacation with my brother Farron and his wife.
Yeah.
And we went to St. Martin's, one of these fucking islands.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're out on the beach. It's a great restaurant. You know, it just looked very cool. I was like, man, I really think I want to go back to culinary school and open up some freaking Caribbean restaurant somewhere on a beach.
Caribbean
that was
restaurant.
My, well, I don't know.
It's a big dream. Yeah,
it was.
Beach restaurant.
And a beach restaurant. Yeah, so that was my, what got me thinking about it.
Your white light
moment? Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, it took a while, but then we were back in down here, and yeah. I just happened to say to her, I was like, you know, I think I want to go to culinary school.
Yeah.
So like I said, sure enough, there's a book, and we're looking through shit, and there was a good French school, very close.
Yeah.
I, you know, wasn't like a four-year degree. It wasn't like going to CIA and doing all that kind of stuff. Yeah. I don't, you know, I've already got the degree, so I just want to learn how to cook, and that was a perfect school for me.
Two years?
One year. Yep. 1 year, all I did was cook. And you just went every day, you learn new recipes, and I got an externship. Basics. Yeah, basically, it was mainly French.
Yeah.
But you had to do, I got an externship at a French restaurant, and I ended up staying there for almost 5 years.
At the restaurant?
Yeah.
As a sous chef?
No, you start off as a nothing. $6.50 an hour.
Nothing with a hat?
Extern, yeah. I stayed 4.5 years because I worked my way through all those stations.
Yeah.
And I was the only one who ever did that
restaurant.
There.
Yeah. You learned the business.
No, I did. I learned, you know, all the different positions. All, you know, I was a saucier, a poissonier. I did pastries, I did all that shit.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I was there like 4.5 years, and then it kind of plateaued. Then me and the sous chef just kept drinking every day too much. And I was like, you know what? This is going nowhere. I can't keep doing this shit. I mean, I'm going until 5 o'clock. You know, it's 5 o'clock. I'm buzzed.
Were you drinking
for
at
a Saturday
the
night? Yeah. Yeah, the restaurant was called La Ferme. It's still there.
Yeah.
Busy as shit. On a Saturday night, we could do 280 to 300 covers.
Jeez.
And it was me, and I was the saucier, so I was on meats.
Yeah.
And the sous chef was the poissonier, and then we just had a guy, Chef Tournant, who would kind of help us plate stuff up, and we had a girl, garde manger, do that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And we'd just get our asses handed to us. I mean, it was fucking brutal. And, I mean, I couldn't physically do that now. Right?
Yeah.
If I try to, I'll just go back and be a cook somewhere. No.
Really?
No,
but you can get on a fucking truck with a mower?
Yeah, oh yeah, I'm a man. Yeah, I'm a man.
But the cooking thing was crazy.
Yeah, I couldn't.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Just thinking about dupes that aren't stopping right now can make me panic. When you just look up at that thing and there's nothing but tickets, it's like, what the fuck? How's this ever going to happen? People want their pancakes.
Yep.
But I imagine it's horrible to balance.
Then the chef owner would be expediting. He's calling all these fucking tickets and...
Oh, that guy on the wheel.
Oh, my God. Well, ours were up on, you know, they're up above us.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, we could have 30, 35 tickets, and they're just calling, like, you know, but our stuff was like Chateaubriand and, you know, Dover sole and all this kind of shit we're putting out. And I had, like, you know, all these different elements to each plate, and it was like, oh, my God. And I fucked up a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. For a while, I did.
I remember that just from working with you at Edibles. There was a moment where there were so many dupes, and you just have this moment. So I'm like, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if we're going to be able to do it.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
But
so you burned out?
No, it didn't burn out there. I mean, I was just I kind of plateaued.
When
so
did
then,
you have kids?
When I was there.
Yeah.
I was still in culinary school when Nick was born.
Oh yeah.
So he was born. In
you 90. Got two. I met one recently.
Yeah, not yet, Jill. Yeah.
What?
She kind of takes after her old man.
Yeah.
Problem.
How so?
Fuck. You know, I don't know.
She seemed like a character.
She is. She's very funny, too. Yeah, she did get my sense of humor.
Yeah.
She's actually very witty.
Is she all right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
yeah.
She came with somebody. I can't remember who.
Her boyfriend at the time.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And the girl, there was some girl she was supposed to bring to see you.
Yeah.
Who is a, you know, fledgling comedian.
Yeah.
Who ended up getting so drunk the night before she couldn't make it to your show.
Too hungover. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that was like one of the whole points of seeing you was
right.
to have you meet
so
this girl.
And she was partying with this friend of hers. And,
yep, and the girl's a lightweight.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, all right, so you have Nick, and you're doing the cooking. And I don't know when you and Kathy got married even.
I did 89.
Oh, wow. Yeah, we missed these big chunks. So, okay, so when do you take the control of a kitchen
in terms of like an actual manager, like a sous chef? So I did the French restaurant for 4.5 years.
Yeah.
Then I took a sous chef position down here at the Jockey Club, which was, that's my first chef's job.
And a sous chef is the right hand man, right?
It literally means under chef.
Right.
So you are under the executive chef.
Okay.
The executive chef, George, I'm not going to give his last name, but he had a bit of a drinking problem.
Uh-huh.
And, he and I were supposed to be working together.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and then he would call me up and go, I'm going to go sit in the office and just need you to make sure lunch is on. I'm like, so basically I was doing the lunch and he was like all fucked up.
Yeah.
Sitting in the office.
Restaurant,
you know,
business.
Yeah, sleeping it off.
Yeah.
But unfortunately it did catch up to him, so they got rid of him. And then this is like the millennial year, right? The 2000.
2000, yeah.
99 going to 2000.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, I mean, I'd been a cook and now a sous chef for like 5 months. And they said, you're the chef now. So I'm like, okay. And by the way, you have, you know, we have the 2000 coming up, the Y2K bullshit.
Yeah.
And they had to do all these menus. And
yeah.
So it's sink or swim.
Yeah.
So I didn't get fired. I actually did a pretty good job. Got us through all that bullshit. Yeah. And then by April that year, they brought an actual executive chef. They brought from the company.
Yeah.
To run the whole hotel. Because there's also a banquet side.
Okay, so
I was too green.
Yeah, yeah. But you were able to, how long did you hold
it? For the restaurant. I was cool with the restaurant.
4 months?
Yeah, from like November till April.
And then where'd you go?
Well, that was my foray into Starwood. That was what got me into Starwood Hotels. I was with them for almost 17 years.
Wow.
Yeah, so then I, you know, moved around as a chef.
Yeah.
Was at the Westin for 13 of those years.
Wow, head chef?
Yep, executive chef there.
Wow. An executive chef, you just run the whole kitchen?
Yeah,
you
run.
Go around
if you're the executive chef at a hotel, runs all the culinary. So, because you have banquet side
and stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, I was cooking too. Trust me.
Yeah.
I mean, I did a lot of pastry, so we did a lot of weddings.
Yeah. You make a good wedding cake?
Well, good funny story about that too. It wasn't my wedding cake, but back at the French restaurant, I learned a lot of pastry from Alain. Alain Roussel was the chef owner.
Yeah.
Right from France. And we did a lot of weddings on the weekends, right? So he had just, here's his menu, this is what you get.
Yeah.
Don't ask questions, this is how you're gonna get it. So we provided these mousse cakes. We always made these mousse cakes for the weddings.
Yeah.
Well, I would always make the cake for him, right? Then he would dress it with the fondant and do all that shit.
Yeah.
And you have to take acetate and you line the inside of the ring mold.
Right.
Because that's how you shape your
layers,
right? Well, when you assemble the cake, you got to take the ring mold off and the acetate, right? Because it's a strip of plastic. Well, he didn't. So it's the wedding and we're in the kitchen, which is downstairs. And all of a sudden we hear all this fucking commotion going on.
On every pan though?
And let's say you do three layers. Yeah. Each one has to have this acetate so you can take the mold off.
Yeah, but
he didn't take it off of any of them. He totally forgot about it. So the bride and groom, they're cutting the cake.
Yeah.
And they're cutting, like they're sawing through the, they're like, what is this shit? There's fucking plastic in it. So we had to take the whole cake back downstairs, take all the fondant off.
And re-ice
remove
it?
Remove the plastic, you know, the acetate. And he felt bad because it was his, you know, he did it, not me. I'm like, help, hands up. I didn't do it.
Memorable
I made
wedding.
It for you.
Memorable wedding.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Keep that video.
Yeah.
The joke cake.
Yeah. Well, we also remember the sous chef. Scott was doing it's a very classic dish where you make a bisque or whatever, and you have this lion's foot bowl, and you put the bisque in it, and then you cover it with puff pastry and you bake it. So you serve it, they break through the top, eat the soup, they get this nice puff pastry.
Yeah.
Well, we were busy as shit for lunch, and he's knocking these things out, right? Yeah. And takes like 15 minutes from ordering.
Yeah.
Finally, waiter comes down, he's got his tray, and there's this fucking bowl there with the puff pastry and a hole in it. He goes, chef, there's no soup in it. He baked the puff, but didn't put soup in the bowl. Like, surprise, nothing's coming out of this cake. I mean, the poor customer. But I think the customer, so he got all mad at himself. But I was laughing because it was kind of funny at the time.
But you never thought, like, I'm going to open a restaurant?
I have. I've always thought about that. Never did it.
Yeah.
Because another guy went to culinary school who's quite successful, opened a restaurant. And I don't know, what am I, 59 now? So this has got to be over 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I stopped in. I stopped in his place. Go, hey, Damien. I said, you know, and there is a Sunday. I'm like off from work, getting a haircut. He's sweating. He's fucking all, you know, he's like soaking wet.
Yeah.
He's in his place working.
Yeah.
So he takes a break and he and I are just talking. And it was his first Sunday open for brunch and they were busy as shit.
Right.
And he's cooking omelets and doing all that stuff. Man, I'm thinking to myself, God, I'm glad I'm not doing that. And I was talking to him. I said, you know, I was thinking about opening a place because at this point, I think I was mid 40s.
Yeah.
I said, you know, you did it successfully. What did it take for you to do that? Yeah. He goes, well, for the first 2 years, I worked from 9 a.m. till 2 a.m. every day, 7 days a week. I'm like, count me out. Fuck that. I'm not doing that. Like 9 a.m. I work from 9 a.m. till 11 a.m. Take a break. I mean, give me a break. I'm not doing. So that he pretty much talked me out of it.
Oh my God. I mean, that's a rough business.
Well, you know, then you're counting on people showing up for work, and that doesn't happen a lot.
Oh, that's right, dude.
And that's, you know, that's, I mean, I didn't own the place, but I mean, I've been managing kitchens for years. And I mean, I'd get these fucking texts at like 4 a.m, chef, I can't come in. My breakfast cook.
Yeah.
So I'm going in at 4:30 a.m. I'm opening the kitchen, cooking breakfast. I'm like, why am I doing that?
But you were working for the government towards the end?
I was with NIH. I was a senior executive chef there at the end.
Yeah. But like, was it, did you like it?
No.
No.
There, I mean, you know, there's always takeaways, right? I mean, there are, I had people I liked. I liked working with the, you know, a lot of the staff. I liked a lot of what we did because I was able to actually introduce things like, you know, because I have a different background from a lot of the chefs that are in that kind of kitchen. And so I was able to do things and they had never seen before. So I was like, you know, that was fun to like teach people or try something different with the clientele. And they'd be like, oh, this is fucking awesome. You know, it's just so... It's nice to do that, but in the end, it's still a job. And, you know, NIH was rough.
Yeah.
Because there's so many facets, and the client can be difficult. And
it's the National Institute of Health?
Yep. Yeah, right in Bethesda. Yeah.
And that was the last job?
That was my last. Yeah, right up until April 31st of this year.
Yeah. And where'd you get your pension from? From them?
Oh, I have no pension.
Oh, you don't?
No, no. Yeah. I mean, I've been a
you pretty, save your own. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Savvy investor. So.
But the government, you didn't work for them long enough to have.
No, and it wasn't. I didn't work for the government. I was a contractor.
Oh, he's a contractor.
Right. So we were a private company.
Wow. And now you're doing landscaping.
Yep.
Great.
Yep. Well,
wait, now, how old is your son?
20. God, he's going to be what? 27?
And he's married?
No.
Oh.
No.
Oh. And the daughter's not married.
No. God, no. No, she's young, though. I mean, she better not be married. She's not even, she'll turn 23. He turns 27. That's right. There's 4 years apart.
And it was challenging?
Yeah, big nod of the head. Yes, you see that? Yep.
But you seem okay.
I love her, you know?
Yeah, but both of them, the son, he's like...
Very different.
Yeah.
I mean, Nick is Wharton grad.
Yeah.
Super, you know, straight.
Yeah.
Not straight, but I mean, in terms of, he's not straight, actually.
He's not straight at all.
No, no. But,
how was that?
But, no, but
a gay kid for you.
I don't care. Never bothered me.
Never.
No.
That's great.
Didn't really faze me.
Did that surprise you?
Bother me?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, you know, different, I'm upstate New York, white guy, you know, grew up with construction.
Yeah.
You'd think it would, right?
Right.
You'd think, oh, you guys must be a bunch of fucking rednecks. But I don't care. You know, just never really,
good
was
kid.
Never an issue. Yeah, real good kid. Yep.
Oh, that's great.
Swimming, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
And Kathy's doing good. Is she retired?
No, I'm sure she wants to.
Yeah?
No, she works hard. She works her ass off. National Academy of Sciences. So she's an editor, and she's kind of like learning this as she goes because it's technical stuff, which I don't know what the hell that is.
How'd she end up there?
It was a part-time gig. She's been trying to do juggle the kids for all these years and find jobs that kind of suited the balance. Because clearly I couldn't.
Yeah.
So she had to, unfortunately, and she did. But she sacrificed a lot.
Yeah.
And she was working two jobs for freaking ever.
Yeah.
And just killing herself. So she left the one this year.
Yeah.
Yep. And now she took this one full time, but it's still a lot of work.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, she's not jumping into trucks and taking out her hip, but you know,
she
looks stressed.
And she you don't have to do that.
I guess not. But it's an option.
Do you still play softball with the Fugazi guy?
Ian.
Yeah,
a bunch of their all these old, you know, rockers,
the punk rockers from the DC scene.
Yeah, well, Ian Fugazi and then Mike Russell, who's with Shudder to Think. And Kim Coletta was a Jawbox, and she's actually still recording. They're doing something now. She's in the studio doing something.
Yeah, I wish I can't remember. Like, there's some things I don't remember about me. People
like duration of time.
Well, because like I remember I lived in Somerville at Dave Cross's, like at Bill Wilson's place when I came back, but I was sleeping in Dave's bed when he was at his girlfriend's, and I'd sleep on the couch, but I don't know how long that went on for.
So out of all the places you've lived at, what place do you have the most endearment to?
Well, it's weird as time goes on. Like I just was in Boston, and I never go there. But I remember it.
Yeah.
Because I've separate sets of memories from Boston. I have the memories of us,
you know, in college and shortly after college. Then I have the horrible memories of going back there to start doing comedy and doing those rooms and, you know, doing coke and doing all that whole bit of, and I'm like, it's traumatized. Yeah, when I go back there, I'm like, oh God, this is where it happened. You know,
there's that sidewalk.
Exactly. It's that kind of shit. But it's a weird city. And San Francisco, like, I was kind of buzzed a lot, and it sort of is surreal. I would say that New York, I was probably the best time.
Yeah.
Once I kind of got grounded there and did all the stuff I did. I had a place out in Astoria with that woman who I married, and then I fucked that marriage up, and then 9/11 happened.
Yeah. So how many times have you been married?
Twice, no kids. I do joke about that. Takes a special kind of asshole.
Yeah, of course.
To have two wives and no kids.
Yeah, well.
I've brought that joke back several times.
Yeah, I'm sure. It's so good. It's so relevant.
Yeah, I mean, but yeah, I think New York and L.A.'s been good. I love my house in L.A., but everything's going to burn.
It's going to burn.
Yeah.
It's fire season.
It is. There's no water and it's burning. It's God, like you just sort of wait. But I love the fucking house. Would you like where you live here?
Yeah, I mean, we have a great location because it's very close to downtown D.C.
Yeah.
You know, 10 miles, but everything is accessible.
Yeah. Is it a house or a condo?
It's a house, yeah.
Yeah?
Yep. And all the pricing went, you know, sky high.
So you're good?
Oh, fuck yeah. Yeah.
That's nice to know.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been cheap.
Yeah.
Definitely didn't live beyond it. Oh, hell yeah. Yep. Yep.
You're always kind of proud of it.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. But we ended up buying. Yeah. You know, we've been in the house for as long as Nick is old.
Oh wow.
So we moved in when he was like 3 weeks old.
And you didn't take out money against it?
No.
Oh.
No. We ended up building on the back, extending the kitchen, knocking some walls out, that kind of shit. So we've done some work to it, but
oh, that's good.
Yeah, I mean,
it's nice to have.
We've been there for 27 years, and
is it paid off?
Oh yeah. Oh, almost. Yeah. I got like, you know, some left, not a lot, but I mean. At the time, so we live in Silver Spring.
Yeah.
And downtown Silver Spring back then was a fucking war zone.
Yeah.
Buildings boarded up.
Yeah.
Restaurants, everything's closed.
Yeah.
It was a dump.
Oh, yeah.
So it depressed the area. Well, so we got a good deal on a house, right? Because we didn't have any money. I was making $6.50 an hour at that French restaurant.
Yeah.
Like, not making shit.
Yeah.
And we needed a house. So we got a house for a very good price. And within a few years, they started redeveloping downtown.
Yeah.
Now it looks like fucking Bethesda.
Yeah.
Now it's gone crazy.
Yeah.
So, of course, all the values have just gone.
Like, oh, wow.
Like
that's
San Francisco, right? It's like.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Not anymore. San Francisco took a big hit during COVID.
Dude. Oh, it did?
Yeah, because all that tech money, everyone realized they didn't have to go to work.
That's
so
true.
All, stay you know, home. Everything that was holding that city together got pulled out from under it. And it's a little scary. It's a little weird. LA's okay. You know, it's very spread out. It's hard not to figure, you know, but San Francisco, I don't know. LA, my house is, you know, it goes up. It all goes up. I was looking in New Mexico. I was going to go get a place in New Mexico, but that's on fire. So like,
Go to Taos. Is it nice up there? You show me pictures.
It's beautiful, but it's on fire. Like everything.
Even that area?
Well, I don't know what's on fire, but a lot of New Mexico is on fire. And I just want to go someplace where there's no fire.
Desert.
Well, I was just in Tulsa, and it's sort of like I got to decide what do I want? Fire and drought or tornadoes and you know, and winter.
I mean, what's Tulsa? Tulsa, why would you want to go
there? I was just
there.
I did a TV show. Well, there's all these little cities. Like I was just in Pittsburgh too. A lot of younger people are sort of coming back and building kind of creative communities and like kind of breathing life back into these
cities.
That's
kind of cool.
What is kind of cool? I mean, Pittsburgh, I was surprised. It's fucking beautiful, that city. Have you been to Pittsburgh?
No.
It's beautiful. And Tulsa, I wouldn't say it's beautiful, but it's its own thing. But like, you know, all these little things are happening. But like, I was just in Cleveland too, and I went to one restaurant. I'm like, oh my God, Cleveland's amazing. But yeah,
oh, Cleveland can be. I've always, you know, I think that always got a bad rap.
Cleveland?
Because of, you know, the river be on fire, that sort of thing. But I mean, still, it's a nice enough. I'm sure they have nice parts in Cleveland that are freaking cool.
I was just in Detroit. Yeah, right? Everything. Those were once glorious cities. So that the infrastructure is still there. There's just nobody living in it.
Yeah.
And it's a little, you know, but yeah, I don't know, man. I don't know. I can't wait till like all these red states that are just these fucking insane red states. Like eventually all the rich people on the West Coast, it's going to be unlivable. So unless they put up borders, they're all going to move there. It's going to change the dynamic of all the states.
No one's going to want to go to California. They're all going to get the fuck out, right?
Oh, it's a little scary, dude. But look, It was good talking.
I'm just going to have to fall in the ocean just to put out the fire.
I know, exactly. I don't, like, you just look at that ocean, it's sort of like, can't you make that water work for us?
San Andreas Fault needs to go now.
Yeah. Yeah, just knock it off.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going to happen, man. It does get a little weird. But I'm glad we're both healthy, and it's good talking to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So that was me and Lance. And I told you earlier that I talked to Tony and Brad. And it was just, it was like, it's not really a full circle feeling, but it's sort of like part of you. It's like, it's almost like kind of reconnecting part of you, like not quite a whole appendage, but some part of your heart gets reconnected and you're sort of like, oh yeah, this is really a living part of who I am. And I think that not unlike, you know, my experience with museums, and not unlike these things, the reason you engage or redefine or check your memories or activate your sense of history is that it is a part of all of us, and it certainly on the American level, on the global level, and on a personal level. I mean, you have to seek to find a place in how you fit into your own humanity and to the global humanity and to, you know, where your heart's at. Sadly, a lot of times, conscience, empathy, you know, doing the right thing are choices you have to make. They're not natural, and they're becoming less natural as people double down on horrific behavior. As tolerance diminishes, you know, democracy will crumble. And the only bulwark we have against that is knowing who we are, where we come from, what's right and wrong, and what we're supposed to represent here. Heavy shit. Heavy shit. I got no music. I got the music in me, but I got no music for you because I'm on the road. I hope you enjoyed this. Boomer lives. Monkey, LaFonda. Cat angels everywhere. Everywhere.